Hey, 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 you're listening to Understanding Disordered Eating with Rachel Heineman, licensed mental health counselor, licensed professional counselor, certified eating disorder specialist, and Laura Sapulo today. And this is episode 122. This is a place we talk about all things eating disorder recovery and treatment and deep work therapy, and really any conversation that's controversial within the space. Before we head on to today's program, if you are a clinician who is looking for more information about how to assess eating disorders and what in the world to do with someone you're working with in the beginning stages of treatment, especially with referring like what is out there, and you missed our educational event, you can head on over to the website or scroll down in the show notes and purchase your replay. This is going to be really relevant with today's podcast episode, especially within the context of, quote, obesity medicine, this newish section of medicine. And it's obviously so, so popular. Lots of people are trying to get help. So many people don't even know where to turn. And if you're somebody who works in the obesity medicine realm and you do not know anything about or enough about assessing eating disorders, we're in for a lot of trouble. So, having said that, let me just talk about for a second what we're going to be talking about today, and then I'll introduce Laura. Obviously, you clicked on the episode, you know what we're talking about, kind of. But in a world that has just sort of like planted Ozempic, Wegovy, et cetera, on the market for people to run after and grab, there isn't enough information about what the heck these medications are, who are they meant to serve, and who are they not meant to serve. Now, I think that because so many people on social media have been talking about it, people are trying to gather information and actually gather inaccurate information. So Laura and I go through some very basic pieces of information that are going to be imperative for you to either make decisions or just come to conversations with other people or just for yourself to understand a little bit more of the intricacies of the GLPs in current climate. And obviously, it is so, so complicated to even talk about this within the context of eating disorder treatment. We live in a world, especially within the eating disorder treatment community, that if you say the word obesity, you are already deemed as something as bad, which is, in my mind, kind of a little silly, because if there's a word out there, we can't ban it. We can try to use words that more accurately describe what you're trying to talk about. We can have more nuanced conversations, but just saying, no, we can't talk about this. We can't think about this. No, 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 no. It's just sort of putting a lid on it. And then there are problems with that, as we all know. This conversation is really, really, really interesting and juicy. I encourage you to hang around to the end. And I have a couple more thoughts just sprinkled in before we wrap up. All right. So a little bit about Laura. Laura has over two decades of experience as a registered dietitian. She's a certified diabetes care and education specialist and a certified eating disorder dietitian and supervisor. She's also a 500-hour advanced yoga teacher. She's also a four-time author. She's the founder of Laura Sapulo Whole Nutrition and Yoga. So they have offices in New Jersey and New York. And she's the mastermind behind Eat Kale and Cupcakes. Laura has been featured in a variety of media outlets. She's presented at many, many, many different conferences and talks. At some point for a long time, she was also part of our IADEP board and is really a foundation within our eating disorder treatment community as somebody who has contributed and taught lots of us so many different nuanced ways to understand how you can work with somebody with an eating disorder, and especially with Laura's case, somebody who struggles with an eating disorder and diabetes. So without further ado, I give you my conversation with Laura. All right, Laura, let's do this. I'm so excited to have you. I'm so excited to chat, and I'm really excited to talk about what we're talking about today. I think that it's been the craze for a while. And I think that it's, besides for people just talking about it because it's the hot thing, people have so many questions about what it actually is. And there's information floating around, but how do we know what's right? How do we know what's good for us? So I'm hoping that we can break down the entire GLP-1, Ozempic, Wegovy, et cetera, in terms of like, just what is it? What's some of the science behind it, et cetera. And then a little bit more of how it relates to eating disorders and treatment and when it's effective, when it's not effective, you know, yada, yada, yada. Why don't we start with what in the world is GLP-1?
Okay. So I think for the audience listening, just recognize I'm a certified diabetes care and education specialist in addition to a registered dietitian. I'm not a doctor, right? Nor are you. So any of the information that we share, you know, is through the lens of the dietitian or the therapist, not the physician, and that we should always refer to the physician as the authority and final say. But, you know, my experience of working with GLPs is through the lens of nutrition and originally through working with clients with diabetes. So GLP-1 is a glucagon-like peptide. And this is a hormone that is, it increases insulin secretion in the presence of glucose. So when we eat and have blood sugar or like glucose in the blood, right, it will be released. And it also will decrease glucagon secretion from the pancreas so that we're not producing our own sugar. So an outside form of sugar comes into the body. And so it tells us to produce insulin to take that sugar into the cell. And it tells the body and the liver to stop producing its own form of sugar so that there's a homeostasis, that there's an even level of blood sugar for us to operate in, because you never want your blood sugar too high or too low. Now there are medicines that we hear about that are GLP-1 RAs, right? So a lot of times we'll say GLPs or GLP-1s. They're all these receptor agonists that are made by the pharmaceutical companies, right? They're synthetic versions of the GLP-1s that are natural in our body. And they too help to lower the blood sugar. And when used in a certain quantity, right, if they increase the dose, we also see weight loss with these GLP-1 RAs. So they're helping to regulate blood sugar, potentially helping with weight. And then we also have realized, or the science community has realized, that they delay stomach emptying. So it makes you feel full longer. And that there's some kind of connection to the central nervous system. And it's telling the body either to eat less food or to taste the food differently.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand, in a body that's functioning on its own without any help, the expected response to having some food with that's broken down into glucose or from some form of sugar is to release insulin and to tell, what was it, the pancreas, to stop producing its own sugar? Is that right? Or was that a different body part?
It tells the pancreas, right. So it'll tell it decreases the glucagon production from the pancreas.
Okay. So that's supposed to happen ideally on its own.
Correct.
Okay. So what was the purpose of creating this, as you said, GLP-1 RA?
Mm-hmm.
Can we add like 7 more letters to make it even easier?
So the original purpose was for blood sugar management. The data revealed a long time ago, and this is like before 2005, that these GLPs worked for type 2 diabetes, that they helped the body produce the insulin to help get the blood sugar into the cell, because people with diabetes are not responsive to insulin the way someone without diabetes is. Right. So they found through their research that this could help to get the blood sugar lowered in a faster amount of time, right? Rather than there being sustained blood sugar, like elevated, it would help to get the insulin out and the body to move the sugar into the cell via insulin, right? Perhaps you and I have like a body that functions without assistance, but there are many people, and probably more than we think, that do need something that helps with the assistance of getting the sugar into the cell, right? So if there's too much sugar in your blood and the insulin is being pumped and we're not getting the sugar into the cell, we call that insulin resistance, because for some reason, the insulin can't bind to the receptor site and pull the sugar into the cell. The sugar isn't actually being utilized and your blood sugar is increasing. And then you're having the complications of cardiovascular disease, possibly cancer, and just in general body inflammation internally, right? So they were trying to find medicines to help these clients not have such complications. And that's how they came up with the GLP-1 antagonist. Then realized, I think it was like 9 years later, that the GLP-1 also reduced food intake. And that's where they started using it for, in a population that just didn't have diabetes, but that they were also using it as a way to approach weight management.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so first it started off as, the first it was for diabetes, and then they realized that there was something connected with the weight. And then they realized in about like 2016 that there were positive cardiovascular effects from these meds. So now it was like, okay, we can help people with diabetes, we can help people that are suffering with weight issues, and we can help people that are suffering with cardiac issues.
Huh. Was there any known connection with the cardiac issues, or was it just a thing that they're like, oh, cool?
Well, most people that have inflammation end up having, you know, diabetes and cardiovascular side effects. So mm-hmm. I think it's something that they're always looking at together anyway, right? So if I'm at, you know, doing my CEUs on diabetes, like there's always going to be a conversation around inflammation, usually cancer, usually like hypertension or heart disease or cholesterol, something like that, because it's part of metabolic syndrome, right? That there's all mm-hmm. these different prongs and diabetes is just one of them.
Okay, that makes sense.
So if you're looking at a med, you want to, like, if there's a med and it's addressing all of these things, great.
Right. Seems to be perfect. So is it?
Well, I think we all know nothing is perfect. And anything in excess or deficiency is typically not useful psychologically, right? Like, we never want to take that black or white approach. And I think these medicines that were so very awesome for the population that is diagnosed with diabetes, that it's worked really well, you know, but I think there's dangers now with the GLP-1 RAs being offered to a wider population. Not that I think that it shouldn't be offered. You know, I think everybody is an individual and we have to look at each person holistically, but I do think there's really a large space for error and for trigger or exacerbating eating disorders, while there's also a space for actually helping people with eating disorders, specifically more likely like a binge eating disorder.
Interesting. Okay, so let's get into that in a little bit, but first backtrack. Obviously, nothing is perfect. So at some point, someone figured this out and then they expanded the reach, not just to people with insulin resistance or diabetes that this was helpful for or intended for, but they sort of expanded it to the general population, perhaps people that were, you know, saying that they were struggling with their weight, their doctor recommended, let's just say they fell in under some sort of criteria. So what happens next in terms of the trajectory of the drug? What did we learn? What's people's experience taking it?
For specifically diabetes, or diabetes and weight management, or just weight management in and of itself?
So I was thinking weight management in and of itself, unless there was more.
So the people that I'm seeing using these medications usually have some form of insulin resistance, right? And that's how maybe the topic comes up, is that when you eat a meal that has carbohydrate, there is an abnormal response of insulin and an abnormal response with blood sugar. And so maybe the dietary strategies and the other behavioral strategies, whether it's mindfulness and breathing or exercise, aren't sufficient, or for some reason the person isn't able to use those strategies and then overcome, or they're not able to use those strategies but not able to actually resist urges, right, or impulses to act with the food at another period of time. So the individual would then be considered for one of these GLP-1 meds, right?
Wait, let me just make sure I understand. This is a person who's struggling with specific foods that are harmful almost medically to them, and they almost can't seem to stop eating them. Is that what you're saying?
So somebody with insulin resistance, right? So maybe it's a client that has polycystic ovary syndrome. Maybe it's a woman in menopause, or maybe it's somebody with like prediabetes, or somebody that's body just is metabolically different. And so they eat like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and their blood sugar ends up hitting 200, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas you take like a healthy 20-year-old, they eat the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, their blood sugar maybe hits 140, mm-hmm. right? So these people, this particular population where their blood sugar is going to be elevated, their insulin is going to be elevated. It's like, oh, let's look at the GLPs. Right. Mm-hmm. If like the dietary changes don't produce a significant enough result, meaning like maybe the dietary changes and exercise and breathing gets you to 160, but like there's still inflammation in the body, there's still this tendency to be high. So they look at a GLP. Mm-hmm. And then someone starts on this GLP at a low dose, right? Depending on what it is, it's as low as possible. And that could be for a month. And then they slowly go up and they watch how the body responds, how the person responds to the food, if they're using a little machine called a continuous glucose monitor, right? So this is like in the more perfect ideal world, right? Right. And that's more like what I'm seeing in my practice, because everybody is being looked at in a more holistic manner and the doctors are working, the individuals and the dietitian and the therapist, and it's this really cohesive team. The flip side of the coin is the person that walks into the doctor's office and says, you know, I can't get my weight off, I need one of these medicines. And the doctor just writes the script. And the person never tried the behavioral change or doesn't try the behavioral change before and then with the medicine. Mm-hmm. Because then what happens is these are expensive medicines, right? And so if they're not going to continue on them, it's going to be like any other medicine. They're going to come off and they're going to regain the weight, right? Because you have to be able to implement the behaviors. If there was no implementation of behavior, and it's very hard to actually do the behaviors or the hopeful behaviors on the medicine, because it literally takes away the urge to eat. And that's why a lot of individuals with binge eating disorder feel like, oh my God, like I finally don't have that voice in my head.
Right.
I don't have that nagging saying like, eat this or keep eating, keep going. They're like, it's finally silent. I can just have like a breather, you know, and it's so peaceful for me. But the thing is, you know, many clients report that they're just not hungry. So maybe they eat a nibble in the morning and they eat a little nibble in the evening. Usually there's nothing midday from my experience. And so are they really implementing behaviors? And then the people that had never seen a dietitian or a therapist, right? Like they're definitely not implementing behaviors. They're just eating a tiny bit of pasta at night and a tiny bit of like toast in the morning because that's what's easy to digest. It doesn't sit in the stomach long, doesn't make them feel overly nauseous. And then they're ending up losing a lot of weight really quickly, but they're not learning how to eat. And they're usually so sick that they can't exercise to the capacity, so they can't increase their physical fitness. And what happens when you lose weight fast is you lose your lean body mass, right? So then you're going to be left at a lower weight, but have more fat mass and less lean body mass. And therefore you'll be less metabolically active. So at the end of the day, then you wouldn't be able to consume as many calories like on a normal day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're going to see is a set of the population that started on these drugs without any support, right? Where they just took it, went to the doctors, got the script, or they went online and got the script, that at some point when the script runs out or they can't afford to continue with it, they're going to automatically go back to their old behaviors. But the thing is, it's going to be like the yo-yo diet, right? Where they've dropped weight and now all of a sudden they go back to eating, but they're actually metabolically slower. So they're going to gain even more weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think if you are to use a medicine like this, you really have to think about the individual person and what's right for them, rather than just writing the script for everybody. Because, okay, great. Yeah, it does bring a lot of peace of mind to people, but it's not going to bring peace of mind, and nor will it bring health if somebody is going to end up more sick later on, right? Yeah. The research shows it's better to stay at a higher weight than to drop significantly and then regain that weight plus more. That causes even more inflammation in the body. And again, inflammation is what causes diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer.
Okay. People have been complaining of side effects and different, you know, gastro issues. Can you speak to the side effects just for a second? What have you come across? Like, what do people experience, especially the people who are taking this medication purely for weight loss?
Most people experience some type of nausea, which is believed to be the effect of the GLP-1 in the central nervous system. And then the other part of that is if they're eating a higher fat meal, the fat stays in the stomach longer and there's delayed stomach emptying. And so they actually don't feel well, right? And so they're more likely to vomit. So I have a lot of individuals that weren't instructed when they started on these meds, and they come to my office saying, oh, I'm so sick, I keep throwing up. And it's like, oh, because you're eating such a high fat diet, and these meds are meant to help you delay your gastric emptying to make you feel falsely full. But they've eaten, you know, they maybe pick up the food that they'd been eating before, and then they end up getting sick. So nausea is definitely, and it's definitely a side effect. The delayed stomach emptying is definitely a side effect. Fast weight loss is obviously a side effect, but there are detrimental consequences to that, such as gallstones, hair loss, vitamin deficiencies. And again, I think most importantly, the loss of lean body mass, right? So you're losing mm-hmm. your muscle. So you're ending up with less muscle. So you feel weak, you feel fatigued. You know, a lot of people have to start drinking coffee because they need that extra boost. So I think those are the main complaints that I hear about. Obviously, there are some complaints that people speak to that you hear online about vanity issues, like that there's a certain look to a person that uses yeah. one of these meds. You know, I think for me, that's not so much of a concern. It's really like, how is the person's insides working and how are they feeling mentally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you talk about behavior change and, you know, maybe improving this person's relationship with food or anything related to food, whether they struggle with insulin resistance or not, how is someone supposed to do that if they don't have any appetite or interest in eating, or if they eat, they get nauseous?
One of the things that I think is more useful with these meds is not to be dosing them as high as they are, right? And that's just okay. my dietitian two cents. Mm-hmm. But I think for it to be useful, right, as a tool to teach people, like, this is what you could do, and can you get in the habit of doing this? That would be more effective, right? Rather than just being like, here, use this for weight loss. It's like, maybe use this so that you can think clearly and don't have the urges, or have a small urge, but you're able to make a decision to not act on the urge, and instead use your breath or, you know, journal or do something else. It is definitely more challenging to try to make behavior change if you don't feel the same level of appetite that you normally would. But it's also, I think, helpful for you to learn to go to dinner and just, you know, some people will come to me and say, well, Laura, everybody at dinner eats this, so like, I should be able to eat it too. And then, you know, some of the people that are on the meds will go to dinner and they'll say, oh, I realized that that's not true. Like, that was just my perspective of it. It was just me and one other person that were engaging in that type of eating at the restaurant. Or it gives them the opportunity to think about, okay, what exercise can I try to go and do, you know, now that I don't feel so sick, you know, from, you know, because maybe again, the person felt really sick before in their body from like the food they were eating and the way it was digesting. So they may have like the ability to go for a walk, or they may have the ability to, go do light weights or something like that, right? So it's helping open up or create space for that. Things that maybe before they were stuck on, now they're able to have a little space around and play with it. I'm trying to think of what other behaviors that someone may be able to implement. Oh, just even like cooking for themselves or having food in the house, right? So if someone had been deprived of food for a very long time, and now they have the ability, like they wouldn't keep any food in their house because they were afraid they were going to binge or eat it. Now learning to keep the food in the house, like it starts to neutralize it and they don't feel so powerless around it, right? So that could be helpful. You know, they can walk into the grocery store without feeling overwhelmed, like they want to eat everything because their ghrelin, their appetite hormone now is lower. So there are behavior strategies like that that could be useful to someone, right? That they can put into practice while they're on the medicines.
That makes sense. I think what's standing out to me is you're saying that it's not either someone's on it or not on it. There is an entire range of dosage that could be played with potentially to be able to implement some of this, as opposed to going from like 0 to 100, either not being on the medication or completely debilitated by the medication.
Right. And I agree that that's, or it's my feeling too, that that's why people should be taken off of the medicine. It shouldn't just be stopped, right? You don't just, you know, especially for these people that are on it for the purpose of weight loss, if everyone's just stopped, like how are they going to have the tools to now be off the medicine, right? So it's like, can you space out the dosing, right? And just, you have a few days where you feel like, oh, I don't have the medicine in my body. What does that feel like? What comes up for me? And talk about that in therapy. Talk about that in nutrition. See what it is that you're actually facing so that you can then start to implement tools slowly as you decrease the frequency and the dosing of the meds.
So based on what the medication does in the body, I don't want this to be a leading question. I'm thinking like, do you think it's possible to do that? Obviously you do. You just said. But in terms of based on what people are saying when they come off the medication, are you saying that the issue has been for the most part that it's cold turkey and that if they did this slower or spaced out dosage, that it wouldn't necessarily be that case? Or is it just like the changes that happen in the body are not happening based on having medication or not?
I think one hope would be that the body metabolically would change, right? And that microbiome would change during the time that the person may be on the medicine, so that perhaps they wouldn't respond to food, or their body would work differently, you know, would be more sensitive to insulin production, right? Because maybe they had the time to do some of the exercise and the energy to do the exercise, and now they're able to be really sensitive to insulin. So hopefully metabolically they'd start responding differently to food, but again, they would have been, they have to be a person that was like exercising and has a better understanding of like when to feed themselves and how to feed themselves, meaning don't not eat all day and just eat one big meal at night, because the body's definitely not going to respond well to that, right? If you just eat anything at night, like that's, again, the body will have a reaction. It's like, oh, I have to produce all this insulin. There's all this elevated blood sugar. Now I have to work extra hard. I have to get it out. So that's not going to be effective, right? So it's like if the person was able to understand like, okay, I can have like a breakfast and a lunch, and I have like a little like planned snack, and I have, you know, this kind of dinner, and, you know, maybe when I eat these other foods, I feel more full, or if I eat this combination of foods, I feel more full longer. Or if, again, they're wearing a CGM and they can see, okay, my blood sugar doesn't respond, you know, when I eat this combination together, or if I eat at this time of day, like they can use those things as information when they're making choices. Nothing's ever like you have to do it, or nothing's like it's good or it's bad, but it's like make an informed decision of like, what do you want to do?
Right. Are you saying that it's possible to change the microbiome or any sort like their metabolism, for lack of a better term, if they're on the medication for long enough?
So typically you see, you know, on diet, when you have like diet, exercise, and like mindfulness, like you do see metabolic changes, right? Inside, like you'll see, like, again, people become more sensitive to insulin, like your blood sugar will respond differently. Obviously your lipids will be different. Again, women with PCOS, like their androgens will be lower, like their male hormones. And we all have male and female hormones. Those things most definitely do get affected. To what degree on these medicines do they get affected? I don't know that that research is available, right? You know, mm-hmm. I think it is in the PCOS population that there are metabolic changes. But again, I don't know how long that's sustained.
Right. So the biggest question in my mind is what happens when someone goes off of medication? And it sounds like you're trying to work with that as much as possible by either tapering someone off or doing like an off on sort of thing and having this person learn a little bit more of what is it like to be off. But even, you know, internally, is it possible, and it perhaps we don't know this, but is it possible to have something change indefinitely or at least for short term once the medication is discontinued?
So the question is, if the medicine is discontinued, will we see the sustained benefit of like maybe the decreased androgens or something like that?
Yeah.
When they're off the medicine. I think if we're looking at other research in other populations, you see the changes. Like if I go back to the diabetes population, right? If the person continues with the dietary change, usually the blood sugar and insulin can be managed. They're not cured, but it's managed, right? But mm-hmm. if you go back to your old habits, the blood sugar, the insulin would go all wacky again. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an answer for you, you know, a specific answer, because I think there needs to be research on that. And again, maybe like sure. a doctor or another dietitian would know better, but I think it depends on the individual. Right. Everyone's body is so different. Everyone's metabolism is different. Everyone's microbiome is different. So I think you just have to work with that individual person and see how, you know, you take all the labs and keep looking at that stuff and monitoring it and see like what actually is happening and how does yeah. the person feel?
So part of the criticism from the, I guess I'll call it the eating disorder community, is that there's limitations on the research for these drugs. Specifically because of, you know, timeline. They haven't been around for forever. So it's impossible to say what it's going to look like decades down the line. I don't have a specific question on that besides for what's your take on that?
So give me the question in a different words, like I better understand it.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm thinking about all these drugs and how it relates to not necessarily the eating disorder community, that's a weird way to put it, but there's obviously been a massive reaction coming from eating disorder clinicians and eating disorder prevention advocates because this drug is, in essence, marketed toward weight loss. And I mean, there's lots of problems that the community has with it. And obviously, like, the purpose of this conversation is to talk about the nuance, because I don't think that it's ever a good thing to say like, this is a bad, this is a good thing. Obviously, based on the individual and nuances is going to determine what's right for an individual. But for a lot of eating disorder clinicians and the community have been just sort of firing all of these criticisms of the entire class of drugs. And maybe we talk about that right now before we go into the limitations of the research for a second. I think that we can talk about the eating disorder community obviously has had these big reactions. Maybe let's just talk about them. Like I can throw some out and maybe you can share some of what you've experienced and whether or not you even agree with them. But I think one thing that's been really, really loud is this idea of how a drug used for weight loss then promotes this idea that extra weight is bad and you should go on medication to take it off, which is, you know, anti a lot of the work that people do with accepting one's body. And obviously there is a lot of complexity in that. But is that a thing that's happening? Is it harmful?
So the one thing that I think that we should also realize that everybody's metabolically different, right? And so someone in a certain body maybe eating the same food as somebody else and it looks different on their body. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, when we see, you know, we obtain blood work And then we find out that there's insulin resistance. And we find out that there's an elevated CRP. So there's inflammation in the body. It's not about, in my world that I operate in, it's not about weight loss. It's about how do we help you internally, right? And how do we, and then as my work as a dietitian who works in eating disorders, how do we help you sit down to that meal and not feel afraid to eat the food? Because a lot of people are like, oh, how do I eat an Oreo, right? Because when I want to eat the Oreo, I want to eat the sleeve of Oreos. I want to eat the whole bag of Oreos, right? And then there's somebody mm-hmm. else that could just eat a few Oreos and they're fine. But for the person that has to sit down to the Oreos and they want to be able to eat it, but they feel like they have to eat or they end up eating the whole sleeve, it's like you have to teach them how to eat the Oreo, right? You have to teach them to eat it with the food that makes them feel full. An Oreo is not going to make you feel full, especially if you have an insulin resistance problem. So if you give somebody a medicine to help with that and don't bring in the weight loss, right? Like if you give them a dose of the medicine that helps to manage their response to food in the brain and in their, you know, in their central nervous system and in their actual like functioning body, I think it's a different story. The thing that we also see with these GLPs is that it does act on the central nervous system to decrease hunger. So that, but that's completely separate from the actual stomach. It's something in the brain. And for even food to taste differently. So not everybody's created the same, right? So I just think that like, I shouldn't judge, you shouldn't judge, the eating disorder community shouldn't be judging the people that are in whatever body, right? That like, again, we need to talk mm-hmm. to them and see what is it that you're experiencing, right? Like, is it, do you have trouble eating because your mouth is always hungry? Do you have trouble with food because your head is always telling you something? Do you have trouble with food or have this challenging relationship because, you know what, you were just naturally supposed to be in this body and don't like it? What are we actually, we need to go in and really fine tune. What are we working on? If you're working in the eating disorder community, that's where you go into the session, right? Like you're looking at the individual, mm-hmm. you're hopefully not judging them. You hopefully don't have an agenda for them. I think in the part of society that's really focused on weight loss, right? Like, could this be triggering? Most definitely. Could this be something that causes more eating disorders? Yes, it most definitely could. But it doesn't mean that it's bad for everybody. And it doesn't mean that it'll cause an eating disorder for some people. And it could still be beneficial for some other people. There's a wide variety of meds, even psychiatric meds, right? And people use those off-label or use those, you know, to increase appetite or to decrease appetite. So I think there's, like you said, there's so many nuances that as a community, I would hope that we don't judge and instead we listen and ask questions.
Yeah, well, I think that this is mostly my experience with the community's general criticism. Obviously, this is a generalization, but the not necessarily the judgment, but the criticism is toward maybe more of the providers that are just sort of like handing this out and just like, you know, whether or not someone qualifies or whatever it is, it's just not the best assessment process, for lack of a better term.
Right.
So it's more from the medical community. But I think personally, my main concern would be, how does this disrupt eating disorder treatment, especially for someone with severe binge eating disorder? If we're saying this can really help you with the chatter in your mind and the part of you that doesn't feel like it have the capacity to stop from having the entire sleeve or the entire pie, it almost undermines the other way of doing eating disorder treatment and sort of says, well, this is a quick and easy way to do it. Well, not exactly quick and easy, but this is a quicker and easier way to do it. And why would you not do it?
I think some people are so stuck. I think that there's a part of the population that's so stuck, or maybe they can't afford to get care that some of our clients can afford. And so again, I don't want to be taking any opportunity away from somebody. I don't think that every doctor should be prescribing it so freely and willingly. When I was reading research on this, Canada actually has a script or like a recommended dialogue that you can work through with an individual patient that the doctor could kind of read to help them evaluate like their whole person and like, would this be helpful or would it be harmful? And I thought that was really responsible of the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be able to put that to put something out like that to the physicians that would be writing a script and that they understand, like, don't go in assuming just because the person's in a certain body that they want weight loss, right? Don't go in assuming that. And like, why are you recommending this medicine? Is it just for weight loss? Or is it because, again, they actually are unhealthy, right? Because you have to take out that bias of just because the person's in a certain body means they're healthy or not, right? It's like, just because somebody's in a thin body doesn't mean they're healthy. And just because somebody's in a non-thin body doesn't mean that they're healthy or not healthy. So I think it's really having the conversation and providers, medical providers, having the conversation with their patients to find out what is it that you're struggling with and what can we do to help you? And if they do feel like that medicine's a good fit, it's like, set them up with a dietitian, set them up with a therapist and work as a team to help allow this person to make changes that could be sustaining. And again, like, play around with the doses, right? And see what works for the individual.
Right. I guess I keep going back to this, the idea that it takes away the chatter. And my understanding, and I think it's a really limited understanding because I'm a therapist who works with eating disorders. I'm not a medical professional. And this is the population I work with.
Oh,
that the chatter, the mental chatter, or the obsession is directly related for the most part to restriction or some restrictive relationship with food. And that's like sort of our mind's way of getting us more food. But if we're saying that.
That's not true for somebody in a metabolically different body.
Okay. Can you help me understand that?
Yeah. So because the person that's in a different metabolic body. And again, and then I use those words because it could be even a thin body. It doesn't have to be a body that's like considered quote unquote, you know, overweight or larger, whatever word you want to use. There are individuals that produce and feel hungrier than other individuals. They will produce more ghrelin. So also if your insulin is elevated, you will produce more ghrelin, right? Again, there's certain people with certain brains that they're hyper in the hunger, right? So you're going to be more hungry than somebody else. So it is not about, oh, because I didn't give myself permission to eat something earlier in the day. The person can eat that thing earlier in the day, but their body's still saying, I'm hungry. There are people that walk around, they feel hungry all the time, right? And it's not because they're not giving themselves food or like it's not because they don't give themselves permission to eat. Right. Maybe there's a part of that in there, but they're chemically and metabolically different.
So then it would be a whole nother playing field.
Like, yeah. And that's so much of the work that we do with insulin resistance and elevated blood sugar, because those things, again, like they're going to make you hungrier and they're also going to make you gain more weight, especially in the abdominal area. Right. Like that's science. So I think it's ignorant of us to say, oh, the chatter is just because of restriction, because there are people that feel hungry all the time. And again, the more insulin resistant you are, usually the hungrier you are, right? And there's something going on in the GI and there's something going on in the brain. So the GLPs also act on the vagus nerve. And so that's also how they send some messages to the brain. I don't think we have enough science for us to even really know like half of what's going on inside somebody. And so I don't think that we should judge somebody else's chatter in their head. You know, I think that most people probably don't know what questions to ask to find out where is that chatter coming from. And they assume it's because they were deprived or restricted or something like that. I think it could also be the food choices. I mean, you know, again, like eating certain foods can make you hungrier. So it's learning how to eat all of those foods. It's learning how to work with your individual body. It's learning how to have your cookies.
Right. And this would require a lot more diving into someone's health, their numbers, and, you know, then we can figure out a little bit more of how their body is reacting with some foods.
Right. It's just like, I want everyone to think about, we have individuals that are diagnosed with anorexia and they're underweight. There are many individuals that use olanzapine, right? That helps to increase appetite to help them gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
So it works on both sides.
Right. Right? It is a little hypocritical to do one, not the other.
Right. So it's just like, if we give a medicine to increase hunger, isn't it fair then for the other person to give a medicine that decreases hunger? Right. So again, we're trying to get people to work with their own individual bodies. And, you know, even with someone who's underweight, we're trying to get them to menstruate again. And we're using that as one of the pillars of their, you know, indicators of, okay, you're getting healthy again, you know, but it's one of 30. So I just think we have to stop judging, and that we really need to start asking individual questions of the individual's experience. Look at their genetics, look at their, you know, what is it that the actual struggle is with their food? Not base it on a number on the scale, right? But talk to them about, like, what is it that you're struggling? Where does the chatter come from? What does the blood work look like? You know, are you at risk for a heart attack? Are you at risk for diabetes, right? Like, it's not just about losing weight or gaining weight. And the same with, like, the olanzapine, like, yes, like, it helps to decrease the nausea, helps to increase cognitive flexibility. Yes, it helps to get them, you know, to feel more comfortable eating their food, and they do. But then there's also a time where we take them off of it too.
Right. And I think that this is really helpful for people just to have a little bit more background information, because I think that depending on what side you come from, there probably is limited information given to you, in which case it's really hard to make a proper assessment for every individual, even if someone has the best intentions. So I think that hopefully this will be helpful. But before I let you go, where can our listeners find you?
So my website is laurasipullo.com, and it's CIPULLO.com, so that it's easier to find. And then we're also known for our motto of eCal and cupcakes. So typically, you know, if you go to Instagram or just search eCal and cupcakes, you'll find your way to us as well.
Yeah, you'll find you. It's not that hard. Well, thank you again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, I hope that the conversation is useful to everyone, and you know, that we all understand that everybody's an individual, and it's really about asking questions and then asking more questions, and, you know, making sure that we don't, as providers, use judgment or bias in you know, the way we treat our clients or our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there was one thing that people got from it, I hope that that's what it is.
Thank you so much.
All right, you made it to the end. As promised, I have some thoughts. What I loved about this conversation was that it was full of actual information. And I think so often a lot of us, and I knew that a lot of us, because we've talked about this off the air. And if you are one of those people and have not talked to me off the air, I don't know what you're waiting for. But a lot of us are frustrated with the way that a lot of information is presented from both sides, whether it's from, you know, nutrition science side or the eating disorder community side, that people like to promote their opinion or whatever they call it. They call it backed by facts. They call it backed by science. But it often is very one-sided, which means that you get somebody from, you know, the medical or research community saying, who's not necessarily weight inclusive, saying you have to cut all these foods out, you have to lose weight, you have to do whatever it takes to lose weight, all these medications are amazing, blah, 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 blah. And then you might get somebody from the eating disorder community who is weight inclusive saying that medications like these are just dangerous and really harmful, especially because of what it does to people's idea of what weight is. So if there's a quick fix for someone's weight, that is sort of implying, maybe not so sort of, that there is something wrong with somebody who is in a higher weight body, which means that anything attempting to get rid of it in a sort of quick fix sort of way is terrible. And I think if we were to go on one side or the other, we are going to be wrong. There is nothing that is going to be one-sided. There is nothing that is going to be simple. It's all complex and it's all complicated. And I think we have to pay attention to a lot of it. We also have to pay attention to who you are and what it feels like to hear something. So when you listen to something, does it send your mind into a spiral and saying like, oh, I need to do all these things. Oh, I really have to consider this. And it almost feels like a rule or an obsession or an anxiety about it. Then that information, this is an indication that that information is not for you. If you're taking some of this information and saying, oh, that's very interesting, I would like to learn more. Okay, that's fine too. But I think when we take anything that anybody says as a blanket statement, as you should do this, or you should think about this in this way, we already know that that's a dangerous road to go on. I think most of what I got out of this information is that when somebody is struggling with insulin resistance, this is a very, very different conversation than somebody who is not struggling with insulin resistance, but perhaps has been told to lose weight because they're of a certain BMI. And it's very, very different. We're talking about metabolic health. We're talking about insulin resistance. We're not talking about weight per se. And I think that when we differentiate the two, we can actually have a thoughtful conversation. In my mind, there's a lot less of a reason to consider these medications if we're just thinking about weight, if somebody is not at all insulin resistant or pre-diabetic or has diabetes at all, has no metabolic issues, there's much less of a reason. I don't want to say zero because I'm not a medical doctor. I have zero specialty in these medications, but it seems like that's a little bit of a no-go. When somebody struggles with insulin resistance, especially if metformin isn't working and their metabolic well-being is messed up, we do need medical intervention. And if this is going to be the thing that it is, how can we use it in a way that's going to be helpful to this person as opposed to just sort of like let them run away with it in this weight loss frenzy. And of course, focusing on the idea that it's targeting insulin resistance and metabolic health as opposed to the weight, because ultimately we always know that weight, if you just focus on weight, that's the band-aid. We really have to dig deeper and understand what we're trying to address, what kind of issues we're trying to fix. I think that we have to understand that for a large part of the population, especially folks who are struggling with eating disorders in larger bodies, conversations about Ozempic, Wegovy, et cetera, are very, very painful because it is yet another thing that these people are being presented with to say like, oh, there's something wrong with you. You should take this medication. And that's not the case. So what I'm hoping you understood from this conversation is that there is a lot of nuance here. And especially when we talk about a lot of endocrine issues, we are not talking about weight just for the sake of weight. I don't think that that's helpful, but I will say that I think it's really, really nice then when we can have a conversation that isn't just completely shut down by somebody who says they're weight inclusive and says Ozempic is not weight inclusive, end of story. Those are my 3 cents.